Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
This is where I'm hoping that you have, Kyle, edited in the back of this the ding-ding-leeny, because that's how I'm feeling, and I hope that everybody else is feeling that without having to rely solely on my version of the Michael Common score.
I can look into it.
But that is my way of saying welcome to our long-awaited X-Men rewatch. Holy cow. Here it is. We've been talking about this forever. And I'm actually very excited. I did not know how I was going to feel coming out of this first movie. But I found myself taking just a ton of notes through the whole thing.
Yep.
And getting legitimately really, really pumped to sit down and dig into it. So that's where I'm at.
In the words of Tony Stark, part of the journey is the beginning. We've made it to the beginning. Holy cow, this is about to be a journey we are undertaking. This is equivalent of Frodo carrying the ring to Mordor, watching all these X-Men films. But there's something you are so right about. This podcast was founded on rewatches, and man, it's just fun to rewatch stuff. And this movie, for me, I knew so little about it when I hit play that it basically was a first watch for me. I couldn't have told you a single thing that was going to happen in this movie ahead of time, which actually makes it really, really fun. So in a weird way, as we're building up to Deadpool, it felt like I was consuming new content. So I'm with you. I'm so excited today. I have a lot of notes as well. I don't know. It just feels fresh.
Let's just kind of jump in, because I think that some of the things I want to discuss here will also serve as I think a good launching point for this entire rewatch. So it works out well that way, at least on my end. Because I think, unlike you, I have not watched these movies frequently, like lately. But because of how much of a Marvel fan I've been forever, you know, which again, this is the thing. People forget how much we are like eating these days whenever it comes to like any kind of Marvel fan. Yeah. Like we talked about that with Spider-Man a couple months ago. But like for me, I was not even a huge X-Men fan growing up. Like I didn't even watch the animated series consistently in the way that I did Spider-Man stuff. But just because this was like the thing that we had, like we had the X-Men movies and the Spider-Man movies, and that was kind of it. When I was in like elementary, junior high, I put these suckers on repeat. And so I know them very well. Like I forgot how well I knew this movie when I was going back and watching it, like almost could quote it.
Polar opposites, you and I.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it was really fun for me because I haven't actually sat down and watched this all the way through in a spell. But then I was like, oh man, like this is when he's about to make the gurgly noise and then like collapse into a puddle.
Here's the thing. When I look back at our podcast, some of my favorite episodes ever have a similar flow, and that's Spider-Man 3, Thor, The Dark World. I think it's so fun to cover these things on a rewatch that are viewed as not good or bad, and then find something fun and redeeming about it and then share that with the world. It's so fun to kind of make fun of the quirky things, like you said, right. the gurgling sound. It's just, it brings me so much joy to go back to these films. But what's even crazier, Robbie, is to kick off this episode, X-Men 2000 is a good movie. Oh my gosh.
It's
a good movie.
It is, man. I did not know where you're going to fall on this, but I had the exact same experience.
Some of the joking around is going to happen on some of the other movies. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to talk about those. But I was watching this film and like 3/4 of the way through, I said, Annika, this is a good movie.
Dude, yeah.
Especially for 2000, it's not a bad movie. Am I crazy?
No. And here's what's like, I always look back on this one as being kind of fine. And then I always remember X2 being really great. Like in some ways, I think that the X1, X2 thing tracks the Spider-Man 2 thing all the way to the third entry in the trilogy being like a totally left turn.
But because I don't know any of that though, each project is going to be totally fresh for me. Like I don't even have an expectation now for X2. I don't know where the series falls off. So I'm truly watching each one just for what it is.
I guess my expectations were maybe lower than I think they maybe should have been, but I had the exact same, like I kept waiting for more things to pull me out. Like I mean, it's 2000.
Yes.
Like, you know, like
it's 24 years old and there's very little that actually has aged poorly. There's not that much to make fun of.
Yeah. I always kind of make fun of this movie for epitomizing the era of the superhero movie that didn't want to look like a superhero movie, just because like the black leather suits and never doing the yellow spandex and all that. And that's obviously a part of this. But then there are things where it's like, whether it's because it fit with the early 2000s aesthetic or what, like the X Mansion, like the whole Cerebro area, like they're not trying to shy away from the like X-Men looking stuff. Like it's not like they're trying to shove it under the rug. It was just kind of a different era.
Right. Okay, so let's go through all the nitty gritty, but I want you to go through your points with that being the frame of mind that I think this is a tier two movie. Like if this was in the MCU, it's maybe not a top tier movie, but this is an average Marvel movie, I think.
Yeah. No,
I agree.
It has
the same amount of flaws and positives as like Doctor Strange. Maybe I shouldn't even rank it right now, but it's a tier two movie. That was my big note.
No, I do think, and you know, that's kind of where I wanted to start here is just looking briefly at some of the creators involved.
Please.
One, just because you raised it. It should be said that Kevin Feige is one of those creators that was involved.
Oh, that's incredible. I did not remember that. Incredible.
He really kind of came up on these early X-Men and Spider-Man films.
Yeah, and, I forgot.
You know, it's like he talks about learning lessons from that and what he wanted to replicate and not replicate. But it's interesting to note that. And also to kind of see when Feige left those other Marvel movies and like went into the MCU and then kind of looking at the Marvel movies that followed and how long it took for like the X-Men like ship to really be fully righted and same with Spider-Man. And so, you know, I think it's an interesting, I'm trying to now.
It's
like
an interesting
this.
Note, if nothing else.
Yeah, and I'm trying to confirm this. I'm almost positive he worked on the first X-Men. I know that he worked on the second and third ones. And anyway, so we can, that's more of like a global thought to keep in mind as to Feige with these first couple. But he may not have actually been as involved in this initial one. But anyway, that's the Kevin Feige of it all. The big name here that we just kind of have to get out of the way is Bryan Singer, who would, of course, helm this one as well as X2 and then come back for Days of Future Past and Apocalypse. Way after the fact.
Oh, he didn't do X3.
He did not do X3.
Okay.
Which I'm excited to talk about that when we get there, because there are kind of a lot of different. I that is the biggest reason, I think, but there are a lot of reasons why X3 becomes
keyword
what it does.
When we get there.
Yes. but Bryan Singer, you know, again, here's the thing. Reading up on it some for this episode, I think it's pretty clear Bryan Singer is just not a great dude from the things that have been, like, not just from what he's been accused of, which he's been, if you remember, he was accused of some pretty serious sexual misconduct around the time that Bohemian Rhapsody was up for, was kind of getting into Oscars contention or getting buzz. And
dude, I know less about this than you could ever imagine.
Oh, wow. So just so you, for context. So I think the timeline for that was that, as Singer was maybe finishing up the movie or something, this was like during the height of the Me Too era, some stuff started coming out and he was basically like fired. The movie was almost finished. So they kept the bulk of what he had done and then brought somebody else in to finish it and took his name off the credits. And so like all the award stuff, like Singer wasn't there for, didn't really get any credit for. It was kind of a big thing at the time. I've also read, and kind of getting ready for this watch, I've read some interviews with some of the original cast members, especially Hugh Jackman, and they've affirmed that he was a really tough guy to work for. I think he also had some addiction problems and was just like made the set like a really intense place. Like I think he was really erratic. So I say all that to say, like, I think everything kind of points to Bryan Singer being not a good person necessarily, but I putting that aside and recognizing it, I also have to admit that he's pretty good at making movies like this, because to your point, like the whole time I'm just like, man, like there are certain things here, whether it's the pacing or the way that like a certain idea is introduced with a level of subtlety that we don't always see in this genre. Like he does have that thing where it's like, okay, like there's an elegance to it that I think you don't even get in the Raimi films. You get other things in the Raimi films that you don't get here. But I am impressed specifically by his work on this movie. It's always weird to be like, wow, I'm impressed by you, and also like wish that you weren't the kind of person that you seem to be.
Okay. I didn't know any of that. Good to know. That didn't influence any of my notes today, but yeah.
No, sure. I mean, I just think it's you know, a weird conversation to have, but one that I think is worth addressing out the gate. I also wanted to say on the creator front, Michael Kamen, I think I'm saying his name right, maybe Kamen, is the composer here. And again, for me, this is a score that I wouldn't say it's iconic, but it's certainly one that I know really well just from having watched those movies so much growing up. I don't think I knew then because now it makes sense. I never really knew who that composer was, and I didn't really know that it was a well-known guy. I think the reason for that is he actually died in 2003. I think right after working on the sequel, I believe, but certainly not long after this. So it was the end of his career. But what also kind of makes sense is he was the composer on like all of the like the 80s, early 90s action movies that like fall into a very specific category. Like he scored the Die Hard movies. He scored the Lethal Weapon movies. He scored Band of Brothers. So like a lot of this kind of like, you know, well-loved stuff that falls in a certain genre. So I feel like it makes sense. Like this sort of fits into that. But I did want to say, before I forget, I was paying attention to that throughout this watch. I don't know what your thoughts were, but I thought that there were a couple of moments especially that really stood out as achievements on the soundtrack side of things.
Huh. I'll take your word for it. I don't think any of my notes are soundtrack related, but maybe I was just not in the right space. So,
you know, one thing that always sticks out to me though, like, well, you know that one little scene where like Toad is like he's in the fight with Jean Grey and Storm, and it's right before he jumps and like spits the mucus over her face.
Oh, that's so gross, yeah.
And he does his weird little like dance like as he's about to jump. Like the score there does this like there are several moments throughout the movie like that, but where it's like really keyed into that and like does this kind of like a sinister sounding like circus thing for a second, but it's not very long. It's like just long enough to like take a moment that I think would have like, it's supposed to be a weird moment and Toad's a weird character, but I think had the score not worked with him there, it would have fallen totally flat and just been like a moment that didn't really make a lot of sense. But I think because of the way the score sort of supports it, it makes something that's kind of more memorable and like adds a level, like a layer of character, I think, to Toad, who is not someone that we really like. He's not memorable necessarily based on the script or anything. So anyway, those are my like preliminary notes just from,
okay,
thinking about it at a like creator level.
Can I say one other preliminary note that I took about halfway through the movie, and it is not a con. This needs to be noted. Okay.
Yeah.
About halfway through, I wrote, you can really see how much Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau truly shaped the tone of the MCU. And why am I even thinking about that during an X-Men movie? This movie was released in 2000, so 8 years before Iron Man. And I feel like it has such a vibe. And the vibe before Robert Downey Jr. was, it's just remarkable how different the tone is overall. You know, there's so little, and it's not even a bad thing, but there's so little slickness and wittiness to the dialogue, or like a cutting remark here or there, or yeah, like a charming moment. There's just none of that like bam, 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 Robert Downey Jr. Like, it's so far from that. And it was just stark to me. Pun intended. The contrast. And because I've been listening so much to Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau talk on podcasts and stuff too, and Robert Downey Jr. actually just sat down with our arch nemesis Variety to defend his acting. I don't know if you saw that in the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
But it is crazy to think now how much that changed superhero movies from that point on. It really did. Not just in the tone there, but like in the way that Robert, I think, inspired actors to really pour into these roles and that they're not just green screen things.
Yeah.
There's a lot that changed from that film. And it's not a bad thing, again, back to X-Men 2000. But I just noted, like, none of that slick dialogue is in this movie. They weren't even trying for that tone.
Yeah. I mean, this is, in some ways, I think, the longer legacy, if we're looking at the films from this era in the superhero genre, like, I think the Spider-Man films are the ones that ultimately will have the larger impact. But I think that for the years following, like really between the release of this movie and Iron Man, so like kind of the bulk of this decade, I think things much more took their tone from this film. Like, I think you're right. Like, it's kind of like, it's darker. It's kind of like, there's a penchant for things being kind of like gross at times.
Yeah, it kind of set these kind of films on a different path, you know? It's like, yeah. This is what MCU and Marvel Studios could be if Robert and Jon Favreau hadn't changed the trajectory. Like, what if it was started on this kind of path, tonally? How different would it look, you know?
Yeah. I mean, probably some people that would like it more in a different way, you know? But, well, and that's actually a perfect place to start for me, because I kind of have these three buckets that I want to address one at a time here. And
hit me.
I feel like our comments will likely meet in one of the three. But the first one was, I think it is really interesting how the tentpole, you know, if you will, Marvel universes within film, they've all approached the world building side of this, like in a very distinct way. When I'm thinking about that, I'm kind of thinking like the X-Men Fox universe, the like Raimi Spider-Mans, and then like the MCU. And it's like, if you look, you can kind of see backing up for the most part, like what each one is doing, and they're all doing different things. Like the MCU is kind of answering the question, not tonally, but just content wise. Like, what if there were superheroes like among us? And it's like the Avengers quote, you know, to like to fight the fights that nobody else could.
Right.
And so it's this kind of like, what if there were certain people that are, you know, like really enhanced or something? And then it's like, what would that mean for the world? And so you have like big invasions and like having to fight villains.
But also, just to add to that, to clarify, it's also a key difference is that in the MCU thus far, it's a select small few. Right. That's the big difference between here and that.
The Spider-Man, by contrast, is like the further and even further on that end of the spectrum with like,
there's talking no about one a small else group. Except for him. Yeah.
And I think that's really important because Raimi's basically setting up this kind of timeless version of New York to serve as a background for like a timeless story of one person that has to carry the weight of the world. It's like what you and I have talked about the games doing really well.
Yep.
But X-Men here, it sets up like the whole premise from the very first line that Patrick Stewart delivers is we're in this world where the super people are not viewed as heroes at all. They're denigrated as like freaks of nature. And that is like, that's where we start. Like we start with this like immediate look at like the mutant question and what the conflict is. And we learn why the X-Men are like not really even superheroes. Like they're not going around trying to save people. They're going around, like they're trying to fight another mutant to prevent him from doing things that would not only like make life harder for the rest of the mutants, but also just hurt humans. But think about how different that is
from Iron Man. Like you said, he is a celebrity billionaire, comes out as I am Iron Man, no hiding it, whatever. And then here you have everything you just said, total opposite. Mutants are in hiding because they're persecuted. They're the freaks, not superheroes. Crazy.
Yeah. Well, and it's why, and we won't talk about this today, but I think we probably will down the line. But it's why I feel like No Way Home was ultimately so important on the Spider-Man side as a way of kind of recapturing that essential premise from the Raimi thing. And it's why I think ultimately like a successful X-Men integration will have to do something similar to separate like that group of heroes from like your more standard MCU hero, like Ant-Man or Captain America or something. But again, that is a question for maybe like 8 years from now.
Yeah, how they integrate, it's going to be a whole different deal. Yep.
But yeah, so I wanted to talk about that both just as it's separate from other like Marvel properties and superhero properties. But I also just, I was thinking as a movie, I felt like this does a remarkably good job of like, not only does it dig into that question immediately, it also, I think, does it pretty effectively. And like, I feel like by the end of this first film, and I'm curious to get your thoughts as someone with a totally different perspective here, but I felt like, okay, like this is a pretty, like this is a built out world. Like I feel like I've got a really good sense of what's going on here, like how this could move forward. It just felt like talking about something like Iron Man, like obviously they probably had no idea how successful this would be, if they would have sequels. But knowing that that was at least the hope, I think that this does a pretty impressive job of like launching a movie universe.
Okay, so our brains think a little bit differently at times. We're different people. My notes are a lot more zoomed in. But yeah, if you're starting that high level, what's interesting is a lot of my notes would fall into that category. So like I wrote, as an example, I wrote down legit chills at Magneto's origin. That falls in that bucket. Like building out that character so quickly. I mean, it's such a heartbreaking start and it only takes 5 minutes and you instantly feel for the character.
Yeah.
How about this note? In the non-MCU world, this is a pretty great overarching plot. I think that fits in that bucket. Like my lasting impression of the movie was, wow, like I see all sides of it. Like you're saying, I understand where Magneto's coming from. I understand the world that the mutants have been put into and the sucky circumstances. I understand Charles's approach to it. And overall, the plot of Magneto wants to turn the humans into mutants so they see what it's like. I kind of bought the whole thing.
I know. I love it. Think about how often superhero movies, the finale can feel so forced. You know, like it's like, and here is our final duel. You know, it's like it's clear that like we have to figure out a way to have this big face off. And this is one where I just, it felt very natural. Like it didn't feel like it escalated in some way that wasn't like consistent. And then even what Magneto was trying to do, I love like in retrospect that he was not trying to kill every human in the world or do a world domination thing. And the thing is, it's not even like that. Like the worst part about Magneto's plan, I think, like morally, is the fact that he's going to kill Rogue. Because really, like he doesn't know whenever he's putting this plan into place that Senator Kelly would ultimately die and that it wouldn't work. Again, we can talk about the morality of forcing people to become mutants, but he is a mutant, right? So he doesn't view that as a bad thing. It's just, it's interesting that we never see Magneto even kill somebody in this, I don't think. Like we see the other mutants.
Well, the ramifications of what happens to Senator Kelly, but yeah, that's not a direct killing.
Like I just know, like I thought it was kind of interesting that even the scene where he has the kind of confrontation with Xavier and he is holding all the cops hostage using their own guns. Like it's notable that he doesn't kill any of them. Like he even stops the one bullet and instead of him like killing one guy and then being like, okay, well now if you don't let me go, I'm going to kill all of them. It's like, hey, if you don't let me go, I'm going to kill this one guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like even like Loki in the Avengers is kind of more sadistic than that.
Yep. It's a unique intro for the villain. I think it just helps paint that picture of you understand both sides and it feels natural how they separated Charles and Magneto. Doesn't take a lot of mental gymnastics to get there. And the other side of it is also pretty great, I feel like. That was my other note. I really enjoy the setup of Charles and the school and even the way he uses Cerebro doesn't feel that crazy, and how Magneto is already conscious of it and developing his own device to block that, and how they can poison it. The amount of time we actually get shots of the school works for me. Dude, I don't know. So the other side of the world building too works. Well, what's your second bucket then?
Yeah, so that's perfect. The Magneto Xavier conflict we've already kind of touched on, but I like the stakes there. I like what that Magneto's plan is believable. I think the biggest thing here though that we can't discount is how much these movies benefited from some really excellent casting.
Those early on. Yeah. Yeah.
Specifically McKellen, Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman.
Yep.
Are clearly, which is crazy because at this point, McKellen and Patrick Stewart were already kind of legends in their own right. McKellen, especially in the stage context. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of weirdly...
He feels like a stage actor, doesn't he, here?
Man, yeah, he does. And it's crazy because like he did this and then filmed Lord of the Rings. And those are such iconic roles, particularly Gandalf. But like that was kind of the start of him being someone like a well-known actor from a blockbuster perspective. Like he was someone that had appeared in film for a while. And like he did, I think he was Macbeth in a version of the film adaptation from the 70s maybe or 80s. So like he's been in film forever, but he like comes in the early 2000s, McKellen just decided he was going to start going so hard in these roles that you wouldn't think would require it. But I always think about that with Gandalf because I think his performance there is so good and so grounding for the first film especially. But here it was the same thing. Like I was like, man, I forget how good Ian McKellen is in this movie, but he is killing it the entire way through.
Totally agree. And I love that you highlighted those three. The last thing I'll add on the acting front, did you also feel like Senator Kelly does a really good job? Because I did.
Yeah, I did.
I actually Googled who it was because I'm like, I think I recognize this guy for sure. And I did. But I thought that was a really good performance. Start to end.
Yeah. No, I did too.
He's not a legend like those other three. But yeah, the casting of those other three was the thing. But then as far as just acting goes, Senator Kelly kills it. And then my only other acting note quickly, Rogue's not very good. The girl who plays Rogue, that's the low point of the movie. Okay. So we're on the same page.
No, I'm with you there. I think that that's one of the failures of this series as a whole. And it's one of the things that I think it's hard for people that grew up on the 90s cartoons that we've been watching. Also, because Rogue is such a different character there, that's a lot more like she's, if anything, she's like the fun, like one of the stronger characters, really funny. Like it's like a character that does a lot of, like she has a lot of kind of memorable quips and things. And that's just not the character that we get here. Although I do think that the way she gets her like white strip through the hair, which is a Rogue thing, is a creative idea from.
Oh, sure. It's not all bad. I mean, her first, the way she freaks out about the kiss the first time, I buy it.
Yeah, that's true. I would say I'm actually less, like, I think I tend to ascribe that more to me to the way the character's written. And then I think that it continues to be written for the way she kind of performs it here, if that makes sense, where it sets it. Like, I think I have more issues with it moving forward, the more it kind of forks. Like, I think if we got Rogue like this and then she developed into a different kind of character as we went forward, I would be fine with it. And I wonder if like Anna Paquin would be able to do something more interesting with it.
I want to hear your last bucket though, because I have a comment on Wolverine, if that's what the last bucket is.
Oh, yes. Well, although before I get there, just since we're talking about the other actors here.
I'm just kind of melding bucket two and three. That's all I'm doing.
No. That is like my whole last bucket. So I do want to talk about Wolverine. I just wanted to say briefly, one thing that I also think is underrated here. Sometimes whenever I think about fan casting for certain X-Men characters and what we could expect and who's going to show up in some of these Secret Wars type Deadpool movies, I specifically think that James Marsden as Cyclops is underappreciated.
Like, well, because on paper, when you say that out loud, it seems like one of the weirdest castings ever to me, doesn't it? Like, yeah, he's always like the goofball guy right. and everything. So I had to double take on him. I was like, is that who I think it is? But then you're kind of right. As I'm watching, I'm like, yeah, he does a pretty good job, actually.
And like, I really like his chemistry with really like everybody. But like, I think that like, again, as we've been watching through the cartoons, like Cyclops is a character that is so at the center of the X-Men comics and was really until Wolverine came on the scene in the 80s. And the movies, like the first two movies, I think the first one does Cyclops the best. The second one, for plot reasons, you get less of him. And then after that, it is like we never really get it again in a way that I think is successful. Because of that, I forget how great. Like, he's got, like, we have good moments where I buy him and Jean. We have moments where I buy his relationship with Xavier. Like, I thought the moment when he's sick and Scott's, like, clearly kind of having a crisis about his father figure maybe being gone. Like, I bought that. And then I really like the rivalry that starts here, like, immediately with him and Logan and the way that, like, the delivery from Marsden is pretty great. And like, I like the, if I had to do that, I wouldn't have to, like, she wouldn't be my girl, but then still the like, oh, but by the way, stay away from my girl. It's so like,
yeah. Well, and that's where my note about RDJ came in actually, because he is the only person in this film that kind of gets that going. Like you said, with that line, he's also the guy that delivers the, what did you prefer, yellow spandex thing? That's the closest thing to kind of the tongue-in-cheek, witty humor. So I'm with you there.
Yeah, I also like the way he, the thing that kind of makes this moment as a scene at Liberty Island, whenever they've, you know, Mystique was impersonating Wolverine, and so he doesn't know whether it's Wolverine or not. And he's like, how do I know? And Wolverine does the you're a dick thing. And the way that Marsden, like, he hesitates for like just the amount of time that he should. And then it's like the, okay, like it there is like, he has a comedic sensibility there that I feel like not everybody else in that cast is playing into. But Jackman does, like, he does that well, but Wolverine as a character is just not necessarily supposed to be the one delivering the jokes in the same way that I think Marsden kind of lets Scott. But that does take us to the
Hugh Jackman,
the final bucket here. Yeah. So I've been talking, I've got my notes on Hugh Jackman, but I want to hear what your Hugh Jackman thoughts are after this first film.
Well, bucket two, we were talking about how those are all-time castings. That is such an important thing to point out. Because there's a world where it wasn't Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart or Hugh Jackman. I don't think Hugh Jackman is on Robert Downey Jr.'s level. But
sure.
I see how there is a similar thing that he instantly creates in this movie, a loyalty with fans of, it would be really, really hard to see somebody else play Wolverine that's not Hugh Jackman. He is so into the role. He physically looks like the role. His facial expressions are perfect. He has a little bit of that humor you were talking about. He's the only person in the entire cast that can play off Marsden in that way. Mm-hmm. And yet he's got this charming sensibility in how he ultimately wants to look out for Rogue.
Yeah.
The way he's combative with Professor X, but then Professor X has empathy for him. I think it's an all-time casting to cast McKellen and Stewart and the way they can play their friendship. But then it's even one level higher, in my opinion, to cast Hugh Jackman. And he is the RDJ of the X-Men world. Now, it never became the same thing, but I don't know that you can make all those films if you don't have him in this movie.
Well, and I mean, it never became the same thing, and because the universe,
well, lack of Kevin Feige,
yeah,
the
exactly.
universe maybe isn't quite as interesting at the beginning, anyways.
But in terms
never
of
never quite the buy-in from the studios, like there's all these reasons right. for sure. But he is the father of that.
And in terms of like lasting, you know, legacy, I would say it's not. I mean, I would say he's like the next in line. Like when we look,
because he's. He's also super proud of his role and into
right.
it. That's the other right. thing. Like years later, he hasn't shied away from it. Neither has Robert.
Like if you think about Iron Man, I mean, of course, there's only been one adaptation, but I think that everybody would agree if they were to try to create a new Tony Stark in a meaningful way, whether it was a rebooted MCU or what, they would just, I can't imagine anybody supporting that. And I think that's kind of unique to a couple of characters because of the actors associated. Like, I think that is the case for RDJ, and I think that's the case for Jackman. I think they ultimately will find somebody else for the MCU version, but I think that it's going to be a hard thing to do. And that's worth pointing out because there is not one, like, there's not one definitive Spider-Man at this point. There's not one definitive Batman at this point. Like even some of the biggest superheroes, Superman, right? Like they've had multiple versions. And even if people have a favorite, like there's often room for debate. Like there are things that I think that like Pattinson does well and Keaton does well and Bale does well. And like the same with Toby and Andrew and Tom. And I think that like, yes, those are the characters that have gotten like multiple lives, but I think it is telling that we are getting this Deadpool 3 film now a quarter century after this.
He still looks so good, by the way. Holy
cow.
And
it makes perfect sense to everybody that we would bring Hugh Jackman.
I said to Annika, they have to cast someone younger because if they're going to have Wolverine for 10 years. And then I looked up a picture of Hugh Jackman. I'm like, he doesn't look any older. He can basically do this still. And you got to remember, Hugh Jackman, he's boys with Kevin Feige. You know that? Like, they're boys.
I didn't know
that. Because of this movie. Oh, yeah. Like, Hugh Jackman, look up any interview. He talks about Kevin all the time.
Oh, that's
fun. He visits Kevin's office. Like, I think it was an easy call for him to jump back in for Deadpool because, like, I'm saying that to say I wouldn't be surprised if Hugh Jackman was the MCU Wolverine for a little while still. Seriously. But we'll see. Anyways.
I mean, I would be happy with that because I feel like Wolverine is always supposed to feel like part of the reason why the later entries with Wolverine feel so natural. It's like he almost needs to, like, I know he's supposed to be kind of ageless.
He's supposed to be disgruntled, right?
Yeah. Like it works like him and like the age that Hugh Jackman is in like Days of Future Past, Wolverine feels really kind of perfect. Like he gets into this place of like, yeah, he's like seen enough now. He's like extra gruff. He doesn't look old, but he looks like can look more weathered. So I think he could continue to do that. But I think it's funny that we talk about like the casting decisions being so important for those three when of the three, and I think you're right, Jackman's the most important there. But of the three, he was the unknown, like the total unknown, to the point where this was his first ever American movie, period.
Oh, I did not know that actually. That's crazy.
Like, it's
wild. Crazy.
Which is, you know, another huge difference with RDJ, right? Like in terms of kind of their reputation preceding this.
My wife has such a crush on him. Oh my gosh. That is her crush.
I mean, fair.
Hugh Jackman from this movie.
Dude, back. I always love that this is how we were all introduced to Hugh Jackman. And then virtually every other role he plays, he's this kind of like charming gentleman. But that always has an accent. I mean, because
like
he is
greatest
Australian.
Showman out of nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and even The Prestige, which I think he's great in The Prestige. But he's playing like this kind of fancy gentleman magician. Whereas,
yeah, it's so funny,
you know, yeah, but
here he's literally playing like a beast,
right? But okay, dude, so a couple things. One, what a great character introduction! Like, it's so of the time, right? Like, it feels like that whole first sequence when they're up in Canada, like, it feels such like a movie that would be made in 2000. And it's such a different take than like the opening scene of Iron Man that we always talk about. But like just the him leaning up against the corner of the cage, you not seeing his face for a bit, and then you seeing it through Rogue's eyes and trying to figure out like what his deal is. And then like the metal clinking when the guy like hits the back of his hand. It's just, that's what I mean sometimes when I'm talking about the kind of sensibilities that Singer has in this movie that I feel like just translate so well for a world building like superhero movie. Like it's like you're kind of getting these little things bit by bit, like even the dog tags in the car, you're finding out that there's stuff about his past that he like either doesn't want to talk about or doesn't understand. Then with Professor X, you find out that he doesn't even really remember. Then with Jean, you get the first flashes of like the Weapon X stuff. And it's all just kind of like bit by bit, very organically introduced to where, again, like in the same way the world I think is kind of built out, by the end, you're like, oh, I know a good bit about this Wolverine character, even though the whole point is that we don't know very much about the Wolverine character.
Yep. Give me more Wolverine, please. Go.
So, okay. Only a couple more things here. But some kind of fun facts going back to the Hugh Jackman side. I'd read this before, but revisiting it, he was talking about his time specifically filming the first one and how it was so crazy because it was his first movie. But the difference in the way these movies were made then versus now. And when we talk about doing things, you know, utilizing green screens in certain ways and the way that like certain things even were executed, like with action scenes. When he was playing Wolverine in the first movie, he actually had blades between his, like the fingers of his gloves. Like those are like actually sharp blades. And the reason I know that is he tells the story about in the fight scene, like when they were filming it and he was working with Rebecca Romijn's stunt double playing Mystique. He accidentally like sliced her on the leg or something, like drew blood when they were going because somebody thought it was a good idea for him to actually have like sharp blades on these gloves. And
that's
so
incredible.
It's crazy. And he's, you know, talks about how like terrible he felt. And she was like consummate stunt pro and like thought it was hilarious. But I thought that was crazy. The other thing that I thought was crazy is one of the kind of controversies around his casting at the beginning, which it was a different time, so I feel like it's very much like a lower C controversy. But was that he is, I think he's 6 feet or 6'2" or something. Like he's not like crazy tall, but he's like a tallish guy. And Wolverine's supposed to be like 5-something and kind of this like stocky, like very, it's like the animalistic kind of thing. Like he's not, supposed to be this like classically handsome guy like Hugh Jackman is. Okay. And so part of that, there was apparently enough fear among the creators that there would be like fan blowback that they actually made him in the first film, when he was standing next to other characters, you can tell they don't normally show his whole body because he's bending his knees in such a way where he's losing height intentionally so that the character looks shorter than he actually is.
That seems so unnecessary.
I know. It's apparently like after the first movie, I think that they realized that like the character worked and that nobody was going to care. But I think just specifically for this one, Jackman made a point to always try to make himself shorter than whoever he was talking to.
That's funny. Okay.
And then kind of my last big Wolverine point is just one reason why we've structured the watch this way, and you know, we'll see how it works, but the way that we kind of have this set out right now is starting with this and really going through the original X-Men timeline stuff for the most part, and then utilizing the other movies as they feed into that. So First Class and Days of Future Past, and then ending with Logan. And I think we're going to kind of do that and view this as a saga. And then I think it makes more sense to set that aside and then go to Deadpool stuff. We'll talk about that later, but I say that here because I think that's important because of how much Wolverine really is the protagonist of this whole series. Other than like the First Class is the exception, and that is like the good proper X-Men movie that doesn't heavily feature Hugh Jackman. Every other like main kind of Even the X-Men Origins Wolverine movie that I'm not going to talk about now, but like that movie is not good. But even in that, like Hugh Jackman finds a way to show up. Like he's doing it. The character works. The character's interesting. And I love thinking of it in that way because watching this movie, I realize like there's such a great symmetry that James Mangold was creating with Logan. When you kind of look at that with this, like it's like while I don't love this take on Rogue, like I was saying earlier, starting the series here with him and Rogue journeying together and him having like it's this relationship that's kind of like thrust upon him. But then ultimately he gets this soft spot for her to the point where he's willing to sacrifice himself at the end. And then it's kind of this like, it takes that relationship for him to find himself. Like that is exactly the way that we then end with Logan, with like the Laura X-23 thing, and with like him not wanting to take her and it being thrust upon him and it being this like, he's kind of grumpy about it, but then ultimately gets a soft spot and then ultimately is willing to sacrifice himself for her and in doing so kind of find himself again. Like it makes for a series that is so disjointed in so many ways, the bookends of it are impressively consistent. And I like that you can kind of see all the DNA of that in this one movie.
All right. I totally agree. But to wrap this thing, enough of all the positive talk. We have to go through some of the funny parts about this briefly. We have to. You're right. I thought it was really good. Everything we said was good, but I gotta close this out with some stuff.
I love that. Let's do it.
The movie itself has so much late 90s angst, doesn't it?
Like, oh yeah, yeah.
Like Jean is way too into Logan early into this movie. Like right away, there's so much love triangle stuff. And I just don't know how if you're Cyclops, you're sticking with Jean at this point. There's just too much going on there. I also just always think it's funny when you get these mutants, and I get it, they're not Avengers, right? It's a more accurate picture of the overall genetic mutation in the population. but it just sucks to be some certain mutants, you know? Like, imagine waking up and being like, oh, I evolved into Storm. How badass. Instead, imagine being the guy that woke up and goes, oh, I'm a toad, and I spit poisonous venom out of my mouth. That's tough. That's tough, man. You were, how about in the upcoming movies, the hedgehog guy? That's tough.
Oh, yeah.
Your only superpower is that you can hug someone and then spike them with needles. Tough, man.
Well, also, like, one thing this series will never figure out is, and it kind of makes sense, I guess, but they cannot do Sabretooth.
Like, oh, how about that guy's look? Oh man. That's one of the poorest aging things in the movie is his look and his movement.
And just the fact that he never, like, he doesn't say anything, but he has his, like, all black pupils for some reason.
Yeah.
And so it's like he can't really, like, fully emote either. It was such, and so then they try to redo it with Leif Schreiber, and that, like, that is a character that has not served them well so far.
How about the one time this movie tries to do an epic MCU one-liner with Storm? When Storm says to Toad, you know what happens to a toad when he gets struck by lightning? And I was thinking to myself, where is this going? Is this going to be an incredible punchline? And she goes, same thing that happens to everything else. And I was like, oh, wait, what? How is that the line? How is that the one line they landed on?
I love it. It's.
I thought there was going to be some meta joke there or something.
Oh, it's the same thing that happens to everything else. He flies off. That's what happens. Brutal.
Storm, you're right. Good for you. One of my favorite things to point out is the very, very end of the movie when Senator Kelly is up there talking and everyone thinks it's Senator Kelly and they walks away and it's actually Mystique. And my favorite thing is they pause the TV and they look at it and Senator Kelly has massive yellow eyes and they're like, oh, that's Mystique. And it's so, so equivalent to Thor the Dark World to me, where Heimdall says, it's so beautiful, no one else can see it. It's like, no one else could notice the yellow eyes there? No one else in the world could pause the TV and be like, oh, that was not him.
Well, nobody else would
only
have.
Only a select few can, like, see that, Rob.
No one else had these kind of TiVo capabilities that that X-Men had.
That's true. There probably wasn't the technology to pause TV.
Or at least not enough. Remember, like TiVo was a big thing. Like, for a while, like, it was like, oh, you were like, only my like rich friends had TV.
Pause live television.
I also thought it was funny that, like, every other scene in this movie is somebody in that, like, underground med bay that they have, where I'm like, they've got to figure this out, man. Like, the turnover rate is going to be through the roof if, like, every 20 minutes somebody is being hospitalized.
Oh, and here's another thing. Annika actually pointed this out because she's seen this movie way more times than me. Like I said, she was into this stuff before I was, which is unique. And she had a crush on Hugh Jackman, so she knew all this stuff. But right when they go to the Statue of Liberty, she said, oh, this is the scene where the X-Men actually all suck at their job. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then I watched it. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is the scene where they're trying to show them really struggling. And then, like, there's a little while where you're like, Storm, what are you doing? Like, why are you even here? Do something for a while. And, like, Cyclops doesn't shoot for a long time. And then, you know, eventually when they get caught by Magneto, then they all kind of, like, save the day. But for a while, they are pretty bad at being X-Men. Holy cow.
Yeah, it's especially, like, that's one of the, I think probably the weakest thing about this movie. Well, really, Sabretooth and Toad. I think Mystique is actually done really well. Spoiler alert, I actually think I prefer Rebecca Romijn's Mystique, not just the way she plays it, but just the character in general, to what we ultimately get later with Jennifer Lawrence.
I'm going to have takes on that.
Man, I just think it's such a more interesting, like, when she's mysterious and you don't know anything about her here.
Takes in agreement with you. Jennifer Lawrence is on my short list of, I just don't get it, actors. So anyways, holy cow, here we go.
We'll get there for sure. But I like the way she, like, I actually think there are some really, like, creepy, good Mystique moments in this movie. But Toad and Sabretooth are, like, they're so weird and kind of like sort of forget. Like, it's so telling that the guy that plays Toad, the only thing anyone knows him for playing is Darth Maul.
Yes.
And there's a certain synergy to that for some reason that I can't totally put my finger on. But it, like, that makes sense to me in terms of like encapsulating a certain era, and just being like a guy that doesn't say very much or like actually like deliver more than like three lines, but is and whose powers, like you said, are terrible. Like in the comics, Toad is known as being like this very low level guy. So all that is background to say it's hilarious that he gets paired off with Storm and Jean Grey, who are generally known to be like two of the more powerful mutants, and like easily dispatches both of them, at least for a time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Storm, it's like, do something. Until the Toad comet, she doesn't do anything in that sequence, I mean.
Don't you people ever die? Wow.
No, but I was so pleasantly surprised. I enjoyed the movie overall. Like, I'm actually genuinely excited to go on this journey. And then post this journey, I think post Deadpool, we're going to have some crazy fascinating discussions about, can this even work in the MCU?
Right.
You know, all for a different time. But I was just so pleasantly surprised. I know nothing about what happens next too. Right now, I can't tell you a single thing about it. So when I was watching this movie with Annika, and when I'm going to watch X2 with her, truly I say to her, don't say anything to spoil anything because I don't know what's going to happen. I couldn't tell you. I remember a scene in X3 where they all go to an island outside San Francisco and fight there, but I don't know anything between now and then. So I cannot wait to see it.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm really excited to watch X2 also because it's just one of my favorites from this era, and I think probably my favorite X-Men movie. So but I don't want to like set your expectations too high because a lot of that's definitely nostalgia, but there are things that I think make that one really fun that I think you'll generally be into. So I'm pumped for the next episode. I'm pumped to watch it, and then I'm pumped to talk about it.
Absolutely can't wait. For those of you listening on Friends from Work Plus, let Robbie and I know if there's something you want us to talk about, something we're missing with these movies, something you think would be fun, a unique approach to these films. We're an open book on this, but we are excited to have you all on this journey with us. I think it'd be fun to watch these movies weekly with us. So if you're just listening to this and you haven't watched X-Men recently, watch it and then get ready to week of watch X2, and we'll let you know ahead of time. But I think that'd be fun just to have everyone go on the journey together. Thank you for listening. Stay in touch with us, and we'll see you right back here on Friends from Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.